You're listening to Section D, first broadcast on Tuesday, the 8th of January 2013 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexus. Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. Yay, it's the new year. 2013 is upon us, and Team Section D has been busy over the festive break, getting a read on the year ahead from several key industry figures. Coming up in the next hour, we talk to Selfridge's creative director, Alana Weston, who wants to create a bit of peace and quiet in her retail emporium.
I sometimes feel deluged by the cacophony of digital noise. I guess No Noise was about going back and stripping away some of this.
Over in Vancouver, architect Michael Green tells us how the city skyline might soon be filled with skyscrapers made from wood.
We can build panels pre-built that were 4 meters by 9 meters that we could lift in place very quickly and make something that the structure is also the ceiling and what we feel is very beautiful.
And back in London, designer Richard Seymour teaches us the importance of not overlooking the unimportant.
When you fix something that's been broken forever, then you get a massively positive response because people are thank Lord, you know, finally somebody's sorted this out.
More will be revealed shortly. Elsewhere in the show, we head to Switzerland to drop in on Ruck Architects in Samaritz and Holzer Kobler in Zurich. And in Madrid, our man Liam Aldus joins a debate with local advertising firm Serial Cut on the merits of digital design versus photography. That's all to come over the next hour here on Section D. We begin this week's Section D on the Canadian West Coast, in the city of Vancouver. East London's Stud House may currently be the world's tallest residential timber tower at 9 stories, but if architect Michael Green has his way, Vancouver will soon be building wooden skyscrapers at twice that height. Our woman in Vancouver, Lucy Hislop, joined Michael Green to hear about his aspirations and challenges for the year ahead, why he hopes his industry will become more vocal, and how he aims to inspire his team, with a little help from a well-known childhood literary character.
A toddler runs on landscaping stones, playfully chased by her father. A gaggle of seniors shoot the breeze over coffee, and a couple of students pass the Squamish Nation's welcome pole, en route to a nearby restaurant. Life's in full throttle in the plazas around North Vancouver's newly expanded City Hall. Across the Burrard Inlet from downtown Vancouver, this North Shore is slopeside on the Coast Mountains and carved into dense British Columbian forest. That the civic building's architect would use wood in the redesign is a given. What's ingenious is that despite it only being 2 stories, it perfectly showcases Michael Green's ambition to build the world's tallest wooden skyscraper. Away from the drama of a meeting room cantilevered 45 feet over the entrance, inside, the exposed roof reveals his imaginings for a tower reaching perhaps 20 or 30 floors high.
The building is actually a renovation of 2 concrete buildings that we joined together with this. What you're seeing is this huge atrium that is made of wood that links together these 2 existing buildings. If you look up, what you see here is a ceiling made of mass timber panels. These are panels that are typically chopped up into little pieces by manufacturers. And we managed to do is say, don't chop them up anymore. We want these huge panels as they were. And it took some effort. And truthfully, the downturn of the U.S. economy is what released the innovation, because they all of a sudden realized, well, we need to make money. So, okay, we'll give you the panels. But by doing that, we could build panels pre-built that were 4 meters by 9 meters that we could lift in place very quickly and make something that the structure is also the ceiling and what we feel is very beautiful. And that material that usually is just buried in the walls and not considered a beautiful material, we feel like we wanted to rebrand as a very beautiful material made from very fast growth trees, 15-year-old trees, reconstituted to make something incredibly strong and able of creating a huge space like the one we're in. The original building had wood on its outside, but again, was a concrete structure. What I want to do is actually use the building as a discussion of carbon sequestration in a building for a community building that's very important. I also want to talk about regional economy, the fact that wood's an important part of our economy. And most of all, I wanted to show how it was built in these new mass timber products that hadn't been conceived of this way, because these are the same systems that we are now talking about in these much taller buildings. So it really was a reference point for us to learn and grow these ideas.
Green hopes wood will be the main talking point for the architectural industry in 2013.
Architecture is at a really interesting moment, not only because there are these new structures that allow us to start thinking about how buildings are built in new ways, but more importantly, we realize that we need to innovate at a level, at a speed that we're not used to, and look at big systemic change discussions at a new level. The challenge, though, remains that, you know, buildings in North America represent 50% of energy use and 50% of greenhouse gas emissions, which is by far the largest segment of our economy impacting those two things. Transportation is only 27%. And so although we talk about transportation, really it's buildings that are going to make the difference, which means that's the place, the land of opportunity for us to solve some of these problems. We can't tinker around the edges of those solutions, but one of the challenges is the amount of innovation investment just hasn't been there historically. It's the statistic that we pulled together is that in the United States, 0.0001% of innovation investment goes to building sciences, and yet we're impacting half of climate change and half of energy. The challenge there is that we haven't, again, grouped together as architects and engineers and building scientists to lobby and to become the voice that we really need to become.
When it comes to lobbying about wooden towers, Green knows there's one overriding misconception that needs to be overcome straight off the bat.
The important thing is we're not building out a small piece of wood, we're building out a big, massive pieces of wood. And when it comes to fire, which is the first question I get, people all have the experience of building a fire in your fireplace. And you can't take a big log and a lighter and light it on fire. You have to start with small little pieces and build it up and build it up before you're ready to put the big log on and have it actually catch. That's the real difference in these technologies. We're talking about massive pieces of wood that have a very hard time catching on fire. And when they burn very slowly. So although people, I think everybody that's ever built a fire understands that, it's hard shifting their perspective to understand it when it comes to a building. Most North Americans live in a wood-framed house. And yet, as soon as you start talking about bigger buildings in wood, they assume that it can't be safe. Well, obviously, most homes are safe, and there are ways for us to technically solve them. I say over and over that the biggest challenge of my job is not the engineering and not the science. Those I can handle. It's changing minds and changing people's senses of possibility.
We pass by a series of fountains as we leave City Hall and head to his offices in Gastown, near downtown Vancouver. A giant slab of laminated strand lumber doubles as a desk, and a board of charred wood, even more resistant to fire, unites the ground floor with a glass mezzanine level. From creating airports in Moscow and Ottawa to residential and commercial projects more locally, Green has been in practice for more than two decades. As well as the focus on tall wood and a push to make Vancouver World Design Capital in 2020, this year sees him setting out on his own after splitting from his two longtime architect partners.
It was a scary decision. You know, as a single parent, I have lots of responsibility, and yet it is a sort of rebirth moment. You get to sort of retell the story and reset your vision. And that's very rewarding. And I think that is actually a really valuable thing for lots of us to do at different points in our career.
Amid inspirational quotes put up throughout the office and a box of chocolates that seems in heavy circulation, Green offers his thoughts on how he will fire up original creativity in his 18-strong team.
You know, a couple of years ago, somebody wrote an article about us and called me Peter Pan, and I was deeply offended. I had no idea what she meant by it when she wrote Peter Pan, but then people have made fun of me ever since because of it. And what I realize is that I have an unbelievably great team, and we learn from each other, obviously, but part of the best way we can inspire each other is by kind of retaining a sort of more childlike attitude about things, that anything is possible. And I think for good or bad, I've retained that ability to sort of stay playful and hopefully lead by that example around here. And I think, you know, it creates a culture of a firm that is both fun to work in, but also is willing to kind of abandon convention and try new things.
As I leave Green's office, there's a delivery of the latest sample of laminated strand lumber that has him, with quite childlike brio, stroking the surface as he excitedly inspects it. When it comes to the nascent world of timber skyscrapers, perhaps it's just the approach needed. For Monocle, in Vancouver, I'm Lucy Hislop.
Thank you very much for that, Lucy. If you've just joined us, you're listening to Section D. Still to come, we'll be hosting a debate in Madrid about the merits of Photoshop over photography in the world of advertising. But before that, we're back on home turf in London. As most of us are looking towards the year ahead, others are looking much further down the line. Richard Seymour is a designer with his eyes firmly fixed on the future. Seymour Powell, the company he co-founded in 1984, is one of the world's foremost product, service and transport design agencies, with a vast client list and trophy cabinet too. Richard told our reporter Hazel Pfeiffer about his future plans for a floating hotel, the value of what he calls emotional ergonomics, and the importance of the unimportant.
Emotional ergonomics is the manner in which we design things so that they feel lovely, that they're beautiful, that they work in a lovely way, and basically all of the bits that you touch and feel are finessed in such a way that they just feel more valuable and delightful than something they compete with.
And in terms of the future, you're working way ahead of most people. What do you see coming for design in the future?
Designers are going to have to understand that there are factors that they have to bring into their orbit of activity that they've never had to deal with before. So the impact of genetics, for instance, is changing, is going to be changing us as much as our environment, what that actually means. Understanding how that, certainly if we look at the extension of life issues and what have you, how we deal with an older population is an obvious one. But actually when you're dealing with a population that might go out to 130 years or 150 years old or something like that, then these are things that we can see within the next 10, 20 years. We're going to have to deal with it because our personal physical functionality may not improve. We may be alive, we may be getting around the place, but we're going to need products and services that work in a different way.
Do you think that technology is focusing on younger consumers and ignoring older consumers because they may not be so technologically familiar and therefore ignoring a large consumer base that might be in need of new technology?
I think technologies or the application of technology that doesn't produce inclusivity, by that I mean a much broader utilization, is a technology that's not going to run out of money real fast. What we need to be thinking, because of the change in demographics, the changes in how we are and what we are, unless we can broaden the scope of that, of not just the appeal but the usability of things, then we've got a problem. When Apple brought out the iPad, I remember hearing lots of people saying, "It's amazing, I left it on the floor and my two-year-old could work it." And you go, "Yes," that was the general idea. And by the way, your granny could work it as well. That was very much about broadening an interface or broadening appeal in a way that all of us are interested in doing. There are certainly businesses that specifically target the young, but you'd be surprised, you know, you might say Nintendo targets the young. Well, actually, Nintendo's been getting enormous growth out of not doing that. You know, the Wii controllers, looking into well-being, fitness, sport, exercise. These are much broader context issues where they've organized their interfaces in a way that they're much easier to understand and enjoyable to use, but their relevance in terms of the software and what the activity are is also gone in both directions, both up and down the age scale. So I think most of the technology for technology's sake organizations are starting to understand that broad bandwidth is what the future's about.
And as a designer, you are very interested in the anthropology and looking at human behavior, and the technology follows on from that. Could you explain how you look at behaviors of people?
It's very straightforward. We all know this, that we say one thing and we do another. We're filled with contradictions, but a lot of it is down to the fact that we don't actually know what we do, and we don't know why we behave in a certain way. And when people ask us what that is, we inevitably get it wrong. So I spend a lot of time looking at watching what people actually do, watching their behavior, watching the animal at work, if you like, to try and understand what the opportunities are for design in the future. Because if you see an aberrant piece of behavior, you know, if you look at someone struggling their way into a piece of packaging, You know, no one's actually told them how to do it, but even if they had, it would still be rubbish. You know, these are areas where if you really understand what people do, then you end up with new solutions that not only work, but when you fix something that's been broken forever, then you get a massively positive response because people are, thank Lord, you know, finally somebody's sought this out. And that's brand behavior. That's something that raises your belief and understanding in a brand's activities and makes you want to buy their products more. So this is what I call the importance of the unimportant, the tiny detail in something that fixes something that's always been broken.
Can you give us an example?
Well, I can give examples of where it has to be done. And packaging, product packaging is, I think, a perfect example of that. You know, the little milk containers, those wretched little pots that if you haven't got fingernails, then basically you're going to die. You know, you're never going to get in. And if you do, it will almost certainly explode all over you. These are examples of that. Taking Apple's philosophy, again, on anthropology, of what they call taking out the trash. One of these design approaches is very much about first you take away everything that's rubbish about something, and then when you've done that, you look at what you've got and see what you can do to improve that. And there are dozens of details in the products and services, of course, that just made things nicer and more appealing, more humane. So there's an obvious example of a business that knows how to do that.
But then when you mention if Apple slip up or make mistakes, there's a far greater outcry than when another brand does it, for example. So we feel emotionally, we feel let down, we feel disappointed by the brand in some way.
Yes, we do, and that's the peril of being good. It's an eternal circular argument, isn't it? So if that leads to you going, well, let's not be good, and then we won't fall so far when our things are rubbish, that's not going to work. You have to take the risk of, if you're going to climb that high, then you have to be that good. And that's part of the risk of being the best.
And can you tell me about your floating hotel?
Well, the Echoes began as a concept which we developed internally. Basically, it started with the idea of, could we put romance back into the airline industry? That's where it started. Why is it such a horrible experience? You know, why do I have to fly with my knees in my mouth for 8 hours to start my holiday? And this began to think about, can't we just have modes of transport that are themselves more elegant, more luxurious, more delightful, more, you know, just everything that you really want out of the experience. And that's what led us to that. A hotel can actually define a country. You know, I've forgotten the name of that one out in the Middle East, that the first 7-star hotel, or so it called itself originally. These are things that define regions. You know, a country takes on something like this, it actually affects your understanding of it. It's an act of foreign policy. Look at the effect Singapore Airlines has on our understanding of Singapore. You know, they have to stay at the top of their game because it's foreign policy. You know, it's an instrument of what they are that we can experience. We learn about Singapore by using their carrier. And that's important in hotels. That's important, whether they're international ones that, you know, appear everywhere, or whether they're things that are specifically geared to their region. They're more than just somewhere to sleep.
That was designer Richard Seymour sharing his wit and wisdom with our reporter Hazel Pfeiffer there. You're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. Coming up, we'll be dropping into Selfridges to hear why the world's greatest department store has fallen silent, and we'll be talking Photoshop versus photography in the world of advertising. But first, a short break.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
If you think the print industry is on its last legs, then you haven't tuned into The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly review of the best in paper, ink, varnishes, and glue. Every Saturday morning, we sit down with an informed group of editors, journalists, art directors, and photographers to flip through their favorite periodicals.
There's a huge amount of arrogance going into this, but it's got confidence and pride, and that makes for a fantastic end result.
It's a matter of pride to be involved in certain magazines. It's not about the reach and numbers, it's about the reach and quality.
Matte or glossy, saddle-stitched or perfect bound, The Stack is an hour of opinions, predictions and proclamations about all the titles we hoard, archive and savour.
There is a real difference, and the difference will become more sharply edged as time goes on.
The biggest breakfast buffet of magazines and newspapers is served up every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time here on Monocle 24 with me, Todd Brûlé, and a passionate mix of print aficionados.
I think it's real when it's ink. You can take it home and it doesn't flicker.
Welcome back to Section D here on Monocle 24. Time now to dip into the world of advertising, where the divide between the perfect photoshopped pic and the carefully crafted traditional photographic image continues to fuel healthy rage from graphic designers and photographers alike. Our Madrid correspondent, Liam Aldus, entered the fray with one graphic designer and photographer apiece. They are Sergio Puerto and Paloma Rincon from Madrid advertising firm Serial Cut. And Liam sat down with them both at the I Am Gallery during the launch of their book Extra Bold. The book catalogues the agency's creative process, revealing the magic behind some of Spain's most recognisable advertising campaigns. And here's what they had to say.
I've just stepped into I Am Gallery in Madrid's Las Letras neighbourhood, where design firm Serial Cut have decided to launch their first book. The walls are bursting with colour, and despite the fact that the exhibits are all ads, great lengths have been made to demonstrate the creative processes behind them.
Serial Cut does international campaigns for different clients. The aesthetics is based on still lifes with a sleek finish. Doesn't matter if it's digital or if it's tactile.
Alex Trotud, very well-known designer, describe us like a mixture of pop, surrealism and luxury.
Okay, let's talk about the book you've just released, which is a compilation of the work and the process that goes into the work. Can you tell me a little bit more about the upcoming release?
Yeah, the name of the Serial Cut book is Extra Bold. It took like 1 year, and it was really something very complex, because I have to say that I'm a little bit ambitious. So it's not just a book. So it comes with an app, a free app you can download for your iPad and your iPhone, and then you can display in your screen augmented reality that connects to different 3D figures and making-ofs, videos, commercials, websites, and Zoom. So it's quite big.
I want to get back to this augmented reality concept, because the debate between the tactile and the digital is alive and well on the pages, but the fact that then you can use your iPhone or an iPad and look through the screen and see extra parts of the book, it really exemplifies this argument. Is what kind of debate goes on in your studio with the tactile and digital?
Well, I think this is something that paper meets digital. I mean, we love books, and of course we wanted to have a book, a real book with different papers and smelling, and a cover with some kind of volume, which is made in a donut. But yeah, I think nowadays we should match these two issues, the digital and the tactile feeling, to get a final experience.
Let's talk about the two visions that you outline in the book as well. Obviously, you're a staunch defender of the digital, and Paloma, you're a big supporter of the tactile, because obviously being a photographer. Sergio, tell me why digital is important and why it's a good medium.
I have been involved in digital since I started Art Direction, because I'm more graphic designer, of course. But I have to say that I love the real part, which is the tactile. But yeah, I'm more into digital, especially when the client has not much time and the budget is a bit limited. So we have to go with this option. But obviously, sometimes we made a mix between these two techniques, because we always want to achieve a really slick feeling and something very defined. So maybe the base is digital, but later we add some kind of real objects, or the opposite.
And Paloma, why is the tactile ever so important today?
I think nowadays that so many things can be done digitally more easily than were before. The imperfection of the real and the extra value that can be added, like with a making of where you show how it was made, I think that that's really important now. It's like going a little bit backwards and appreciating the tactile, the manual, the human part more than it was before, just in contrast with all the digital and artificial and the perfect that it can get with the digital. Making things real makes you have the creative process could change a little bit more because you're playing with the materials, you're getting the feedback of what's happening with using like your hands or cutting or pasting and touching things. So all that things that happened, you can make the image like evolve a little bit more than in a digital part where it's just the concept in the head and goes straight to the software, the computer and the execution.
When you want to shoot the project, what do you say? What's the way of convincing Sergio that you should do it? You should shoot it real.
Well, I see what are the elements involved, and there are some materials that don't respond the same in digital than in real. So sometimes light or the interaction between objects and shadows, reflections, like things that can really make a big difference if they're shot real than if they're done digital. That can be like a big argument.
Yeah, the thin red line is when we call the kind of projects that you don't realize if it's made in real or digital. We like to play with this, with also with the audience, but the bad thing is that the clients also sometimes get confused. So we have to be very, very careful with that. But we like that people say, I thought you did this in digital. And we say, no, that's why we record a making of, to prove somehow that we made it real. So the people get really, really surprised with this. And also in the exhibition, some people told me, I thought you guys made everything in digital. And I say, no way, no, we make it in real.
So even your confusion there kind of shows that no one can really tell these days in photography, in a lot of design, in advertising, what is real and what is digital. Do you think now it's irrelevant whether it's real or digital?
I think it has more value when you know for sure it's real, of course. But yeah, the new techniques make it totally get confused you so about that. I think you have to give a hint audience to show that it's made, for example, in real. A part is really, after that, really retouched. So you feel everything is very well done, but I think it's quite important to give this feeling.
Well, I think what matters is the result, like the result to have a quality image and like the aesthetics. And sometimes we mix digital with real, taking care of the digital part being well integrated with the real. But it's all about the final result, I think.
Is there a risk of images becoming too sterile if we go down a digital path too much?
Yeah, I think so. But that can also happen with real images that are very retouched, for example. It's more about where do you want to stop with the perfection that digital images can give you.
That was Sergio Puerto and Paloma Rincon from Serial Cut Ad Agency in Madrid with our correspondent Liam Eldis there. If you've just joined us, you're listening to Section D. Still to come, we'll be visiting two very different alpine architecture practices to hear about high-altitude building. But before that, we're back in London, in Selfridges to be precise. Now, keen-eared listeners to the show might remember we spoke to Alana Weston, Selfridge's esteemed creative director, for our Christmas special about the future of retail and how she's kept her ship on top. Well, amidst the throng of New Year's sales shopping, Weston has a trump card up her sleeve. It's called the No Noise Room. And as you might guess, Selfridges has unveiled a temporary sanctuary at its heart, where shoes get left outside and no technology is allowed. I sat down with Weston in her office to hear more about it.
No Noise is a project I've wanted to do for quite a long time. And I think it's because I sometimes feel sort of deluged by the cacophony of digital noise, imagery, information, emails, tweets, texts that you have to kind of battle your way through before you can even have your first cup of coffee. So I guess No Noise was about going back and stripping away some of this. And what was fascinating was that reading in the archives, I discovered that Gordon Selfridge had a silence room in the store when he opened in 1909. So that was a place, just a place of refuge, a place to take a little rest before continuing on shopping. So we thought, well, couldn't we bring back the silence room? So we've invited Alex Cochrane Architects to design a room in our Ultra Lounge, which is normally a place of noise, a place of entertainment. And he has done a completely felt-lined room with just some benches and cushions that you can just be still on. You could lie down, you can meditate, have a rest. One of the things about the room is you have to leave your phone at the door and take your shoes off. So this is a very important part of it. And so I think it will provide people with a rest in between shopping, but then some people might just come here to escape the noise on Oxford Street. And we're also working with two really interesting partners on a program of quiet events. So the Idler have put together a really interesting roster of speakers, including one who's going to speak about cloud appreciation and cloud watching. Another who's going to speak about low-effort parenting, so quiet parenting, and others who are speaking about Aristotle, who promoted the quiet life, and Tom's going to speak about how to idle. So I think it's going to be a really good program.
It sounds like a fantastic sort of detox after Christmas and in the new year to have some time and some sort of thinking space to be able to declutter our lives. Is it something, sort of the No Noise Room itself, that could potentially stay on, or is it definitely only going to be temporary?
Well, let's see. I mean, it's funny because I met somebody the other day who said, oh gosh, you should have had that for Christmas for the, you know, the poor shoppers who are struggling through their Christmas shop. But so, you know, there's definitely potential for something like that to last longer. And this is part of our constant experimentation at Selfridges. Another thing we're doing is we're working with Headspace, and they are putting a series of pods around the store in which will be meditations. So there'll be a meditation on beauty, on love, even on chocolate. And you'll be able to go inside, wear some headphones, and be taken through a short meditation. So maybe that's something that we could continue to have in the store as they are dotted around the building. And we're also doing them for our staff members, too. So
equally important.
So that they can have a little moment of peace in their busy day. The thing I don't think will continue is taking the Selfridge's logo off the yellow bag. So,
oh, really?
Yeah, so that was our ultimate stripping back, our ultimate debranding. I just thought, gosh, you know, that yellow bag's so powerful on its own. Does it really need the word Selfridge's on it? And then we invited some strong brands. We're working with Marmite, we're working with Levi's, Creme de la Mer, and they're all taking their names off their product for a limited edition. And I think this is just, you know, there is a trend for minimalist design at the moment. And also I think people brands like that have the confidence to say, actually, I don't need a logo, I don't need a name, because the graphics are strong enough and the product is brilliant enough to speak for itself. So I think that's something that interests me, is the paring back of graphic design too.
It's quite a big statement to remove your logo, and particularly for the brands. It shows the power that Selfridges have to be able to persuade these brands to be able to do that. Do you think that we are really bombarded so much by, I mean, the digital bombardment is one thing, but also by brands as well?
I think, you know, everybody's on a different journey in terms of their knowledge about brands. And for people who, where brands are coming to them for the first time, it's very important to have as much information as possible. But as the customer becomes more sophisticated, it really becomes about the product itself. And I do think there is a trend towards people not wanting to be broadcasted to. You know, people want to find out things for themselves. They're used to doing this on the internet now. So things become much more generic. So you might search for, you know, the best camera or best fitting jeans, as opposed to searching for a brand specifically. And I think this just means that the brands need to pay much more attention to how they interact with customers and how they listen to their customers, but also how they develop the product, rather than a blanket ad campaign that's the same in, you know, 50 countries. So I think it'll be interesting to watch it evolve. I'm not saying that logos are finished, but there was a time in the 90s where you couldn't get enough of them. And now there's a time for them to go a little more quiet.
That was Selfridges creative director Alana Weston talking to me there about the wonderful way her shopping emporium is tackling January sales. If you've just joined us, you're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. Next up, we're off to talk architecture in the Alps. But before we don our winter gear and clamp on our crampons, time for a quick break.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back to Section D. The new year is an excellent time for contemplating the things that motivate the work we do, hopefully to help us do it even better. And for architects, who have such a critical role in shaping the world we live in, inspiration is key. Hulse Kobler is a multidisciplinary practice based in Zurich, comprising architects, designers, graphic designers, and curators. Their work covers a broad spectrum of activities from urban planning to architecture, from scenography to exhibition curation. Having worked with Daniel Liebeskind in the 90s, co-founder Barbara Holzer knows how to create spaces with emotional impact. Gillian Tobias sat down with her to get a sense of her vision and the things that help feed it.
The most inspiring thing is if what we're working on makes me curious. You know, I'm really curious, a curious person. And I think if I don't know the end, you know, then I'm really engaged and inspired. And I think that's something we just live. We are like that. And that's also how the team, you know, sees us and feels us. And it's always the sort of experiment we're looking for. And I think through that, because we're living the experiment as well, the inspiration also for the team is probably quite high. That's what I feel. We still try to see our firm as a sort of a studio, an atelier. So we work in teams and we work very hands-on. We have a big studio, workshop for model building, model making. We do a lot of cardboard, just working models, produce that permanently. So we are working very physically, and then we have a huge number of big pin boards where we surround ourselves with like inspiring images, you know, so the image for our work is very relevant. So sometimes people enter the office and tell us it looks like, it looks like, you know, like we would be in an atelier of a fashion designer because we're surrounded by this inspiring material, visual material. And through sort of the filtering of these images, we try to get closer and closer to an idea. We always say we can't design anything if there's no story. How do you want to design anything? Because the form itself is not interesting, you know? You can like it or not. But I think the interesting part is what narrative is behind the form, you know? Why is the form like the form is? Beside the classical topics of, you know, context, urban context, etc., etc. And then it's about how people live it, you know, how do they feel it? You know, what are their emotions? What are the atmospheres they like, etc.?
When you travel in your work, how do cities inspire you?
Well, I'm totally urban, right? I can only live in cities. I'm happy to go to the mountains for a few days, but I'm very urban. And to me, like, cities are, you know, what I need. Yeah, it's people, buildings, the multicultural idea, the, you know, what, the thousands of things you see during a day. You know, it's like, to quote this famous sentence saying, you know, why do you have a library and you don't know all the books in your library? Yeah, but I don't have to know all of them. I just have to know that I have them. And I think the city has something very, you know, similar. There is so much of stories in a city, you know, condensed in that urban container. You just can, you know, if you exit your apartment or your house or your office or your studio, you encounter them whenever you want. And I think that's what we need. We need people and we need, you know, the social idea of living together.
You have offices in Zurich and in Berlin. How does the dynamic of each of those two very different cities affect the kind of projects and the architecture you're working in your practices in each city?
To me, I lived in Berlin for more than 10 years, and I lived in the States for almost 3 years. So when I moved back to Switzerland, I was born here. It wasn't too easy to come back because Switzerland has a high quality in everything, but it's probably a cert that there is something missing, which is the improvisation. And I think it has to do with the amount of money or certain wealthness which you have here, which is good. I'm sure I'm not saying it shouldn't be like that. And I think personally, I need these different places, like a city like Berlin, where people are not that rich, where you have to do much more without any money, where you have to, you know, invent other ideas of living, of working, where you just open up a coffee shop with buying two chairs, you know, but the chairs doesn't cost anything. The most expensive thing is probably the coffee machine, but the rest is really low budget. So I think to me it's very important to change the world, you know, to have a sort of Berlin to me still gives me a much more like a mental freedom, which sometimes here I think it's much more restrictive because things are set quite clearly, and here it's more about the perfection. How can you make things even more perfect, you know? And in Berlin, you don't have to talk about that. You're not there, you know? You don't have to talk about making it more perfect. You have to talk about how you make it work, right? And this is a different level.
You do a lot of teaching, and I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how maybe architecture has changed since you were a student. And the kind of things you try and instill in architects other than the actual mechanical abilities they need to learn in their trade craft?
Well, I would say to me what I realized is that when we were students, we were very political engaged, social and politically engaged. And my feeling is that this is not that present anymore. So the idea of, you know, thinking about, talking about day and night, you know, about what is the social future, where, what are the utopias about the future and so on, this seems not to be that relevant at the moment. Students are quite smart. They know how they can find their way through. They are very intelligent. But I think what is very important is that what the professional architecture is about is not about only self-reflection. It's really about the understanding of societies and also the interest in societies. It's really not only design, it's much more. And there I'm trying to work with students to see if they, you know, how can they be encouraged to have a political opinion. Where is the political opinion? If they have one, what is it, you know? Or what would they fight for if they have to fight? What would it be?
That was Barbara Holzer of Zurich Architects Holzer Kobler there with our producer Gillian Tobias. And deeper into the Alps, in Switzerland's Engadin Valley, skiers and tourists come across a built environment with architecture to suit many tastes. Centuries-old homes sit next to new builds, catering to the ever-growing tourism market. St. Moritz-based architect Hans-Jörg Ruck has focused his career on marrying the new and old, preserving the region's traditional architecture whilst inserting modern elements there too. Among his work, he's noted for converting local farmhouses into vacation homes. And Monocle's Milan correspondent, Ivan Carvalho, visited Ruck's studio in the Swiss Alps to hear firsthand how the architect works to protect the area's sense of place.
Now, what attracted you? Was it the mixture of architecture, the old with, say, the 70s buildings here in St. Moritz that brought you here?
Well, as I was writing about tourist architecture, I was interested what's going on in these tourist places. In the 70s, tourism was known as destroying landscape. So I did some research about tourist developments. I saw that actually there are two things happening in tourist areas. Either you have city transplant architecture, people just take the architecture from the city, put it here without reflecting anything.
Like it's been parachuted in.
Yeah, like with a parachute flew in. And the other one is kind of a rural imitative architecture. They just take a chalet type or Engadin house, blow it up, fill it with apartments or with offices or whatever.
A bit of Heidi Kitsch.
Yeah, Kitsch. Heidi Kitsch. And this is a phenomenon around the world. In alpine areas, this is happening all over. See, I took pictures in Vail, Colorado when I was traveling. And I took a picture in Chamfer near St. Moritz, and in a lecture I compared, and nobody could say this one is in Switzerland, this one is in the United States. It's exactly the same.
Tell me a bit about the work you've been doing with historic homes in Engadina and the restoration. Everyone knows your book, which is quite popular.
In this Engadin farmhouse, everything happens under the same roof. See, there is the cattle, there is the hay, there are the people, and it's an absolutely ingenious and incredible structure. Only maybe one-fourth of the house was for people. An Engadin farmhouse today, it has been actually growing over centuries, and it has had a lot of inhabitants, and every inhabitant put something in. There were new rooms put in, new materials, and also cheap materials in the last century. So the houses are actually, they are no more pure. The sequence of the spaces are no more obvious. So what I do first is I do really exact measurements. I do dendrochronological examinations to see how old the wooden beams are, so I can discover the development process of the houses. And then I begin to take away the parts which are not historical. So I just take out until I come to the pure structure. And this pure structure is probably in all the houses almost undestroyed there because the walls are so thick. When I put in additional rooms, I take new wood, new massive wood. And so this is then confronted to the restored house. So whenever you enter a house, you feel that the tension between old and new. The principle of doing houses in the house, this to the new shell, to insert it in a way that it can be taken out again, is actually a fantastic way to do these renovations. Because when you take the new out, you have the pure old. So in most of the houses I could do architectural work. The hayloft was still empty there. It was not divided. It's fantastic. Through the solaire you come to this hayloft. It's an incredible surprise.
And they're quite
high, these?
They are high. I mean, they are up to 4 or 5 stories high. They are up to 16, 17 meters high. And these volumes, they are very important for this valley, that they are not destroyed.
So just walk me through one of these projects that you've done here in your book, Historic Houses in the Engadine.
So I didn't want to destroy the volume of this hay loft, but I had to insert the sleeping room at least and the bathroom. So how did I do it? I just put in a cube like a rucksack. I just hung it on the wall of the living part. And in here, upstairs, it's the sleeping room.
These are the so-called shell within a shell.
Yeah, that's kind of shell within a shell. It's just hanging in here, you can see. And there's a sleeping room here with a wonderful view to the Pitzkorvach. And the volume of the hayloft is still here, and it's even more dramatic with this volume inside than before. And it's also kind of a sculptural attitude I have here as an architect. It's a sculpture, actually.
That was St. Moritz architect Hans-Jörg Ruck with our Milan correspondent Ivan Carvalho there. And that brings us to the end of this first 2013 edition of Section D. Fear not, we'll be back next week with a fashion special celebrating the Men's Fashion Week extravaganza. Tune in then to hear our take on the London collections and our pick of the retailers hitting the right notes around the world. Today's show was produced by Gillian Tobias and edited by Holly Fisher. I'm Hugo MacDonald. And playing you out, here's my favourite song about New Year, courtesy of the Sugar Babes, the original and the very best lineup. It's called New Year. Enjoy it, and thank you for listening.